Hi, and welcome back to our class, Liturgy, Practicing in the Presence of God. I'm Larissa.
I'm Paul Vanderbilt.
And this morning we'll be focusing on some of the areas of our service that have changed in the last few weeks. If you've been at Covenant more than a week, you'll have noticed that last week we did a few things different in the very middle of our order of worship. And those things are the passing of the peace, which made a comeback, giving, which has a stated spot in our service that's different than it was before, and the Great Thanksgiving. So we're going to spend some time talking about those three elements of service and walking through what's happening in each of those movements on Sunday morning. So to start, let's talk about the passing of the peace. I know it is a highly contentious moment in our service. One of our congregants on Sunday mentioned that you can tell a lot about a church by the length of its passing of the peace. We were commenting on how, for me as a somewhat introverted person, this past Sunday's passing of the peace was a little longer than I was comfortable with, and that was probably the right pattern, enough that my introverted self said hi to those around me, and I sat awkwardly, while other people who are more extroverted were chatting and making more conversation. But this is something that we probably all have seen done at churches. They may not call it the passing of the peace, they may call it a greeting period, but it's something that most churches do this. So my question is, why do we do this at church? What's the historical piece?
Sure. Yeah, and before I hit that, I do want to remind people, maybe about a couple years ago, if people remember, we sent out a form for people to fill out, and they asked questions about passing of the peace.
We did this?
Yeah,
I think we sent out a form about the passing of the peace?
Yeah, and we were just trying to get a sense for how it was experienced. And one of the things that came up through that was what you were just saying, that just sort of a recognition of like its awkwardness. And there were people that commented that during the passing, they would actually walk out.
It feels a little like going to a cocktail hour at a wedding, where if you know people, it's fun. And if you don't know people, you hide in a corner.
Yeah, exactly. And then for others that took the survey, they grabbed onto the significance of it. And, you know, when we'd greet people and, you know, walk around and shake hands. And so there was definitely a wide variety of experiences for people. It made me think about what is the importance of it. And so it made me dig into sort of the historical precedents that took place in the early church. So I'll start off first. I'll just say there's a book that I read I got a few years ago, and I've read multiple times, actually, not entirely, but big sections of it. It's called Kissing Christians, Ritual and Community in the Late Ancient Church. It's fascinating if you're interested in sort of the ritual practice of it and what took place in the early church. You should take a read of that book. It's good. And some of you have heard me talk about this before, but the practice of, you know, kissing during the time of the early church, it was common among Romans to kiss each other, just like it is in some of our culture still today, right? Those greeting each other on the street or in most European cultures are like that. So
Latin countries.
Yeah, it's still a very common practice. What was unique maybe about the Roman culture was that it was mostly a familial action. So it only, from his studies, it took place to those who were your family, your children, your siblings, and so on. So
that was the Christian culture or the broader Greco-Roman?
The broader Greco-Roman culture.
Got it. So in the confines of this culture of the early church, there was this sense in which there was this intimate greeting, but that intimate greeting had like a clear boundary. So the early church is saying that that boundary expands in some important
ways. Yeah, so that's the interesting thing about what happened in the early church is that this particular practice, and Paul refers to it like four times, I think, as the holy kiss, and suggests that people greet each other with the holy kiss. it became a particular symbol but not just a symbol, it was a practice in the early church for those who were identifying themselves in the new family of Christ. Mm. They would, in service, they would greet each other in the name of Christ with a holy kiss. And it was, especially as I understand in the early church, it was cross genders, it was cross social economic status. It's even mentioned in some writings that it was, you know, for the slaves that they were in there that were worshiping with them. It was for that. It was across, it was including them as well. It was very poignant and potent symbol of their new identity.
Yeah, it was radically inclusive.
Radically right? inclusive.
In a culture that more so even than our own culture had clear delineations of status. To say that those boundaries didn't exist in this community, that all together are family,
right,
is a huge statement. And to think about that origin in our own practice, where I think probably very few of us are greeting each other on Sunday morning with a sense of we're family by this move.
Right.
It adds some weight to this act that can feel really superficial.
Exactly. So it's interesting that even then, you know, later on in the church and over time it became more narrow. And in fact, he writes that by, you know, the 12th century, it was not allowed in the church anymore.
The greeting as a whole, or is it just
the kiss, the physical part of it was not allowed anymore, which is interesting. And
there was a lot of death preceding that, right?
Like right.
Bubonic plague, right. Series of communicable diseases.
Right. Maybe that might have been part of it for sure. But I also think it was also this sort of growing sense of like issues of purity and chasteness and that. You know, it was inappropriate for men and women to kiss in public, and those kinds of things became much more prominent.
A redefinition of values and
right
and purpose, yeah.
Right, and then you know, again, I've mentioned it before, but it seems like a lot of things come from it. Vatican II, again, in the 60s, in their reforms, Pope John Paul recommended that it come back. That the Roman Catholic Church begin to use the passing of the peace in its full kind of bodied way. So it's interesting, again, that's sort of trickled down to different traditions and it's become something that's important for the Protestant Church. It became a practice before the table because the injunction, the scriptural injunction to be unified before we come and practice the table.
Yeah, that's worth a pause to talk about, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The idea of greeting other people in a congregation is widespread. You will see that in churches of all liturgical levels. But the placement of it in the center of the service is unique and related precisely to the way that we move through and progress through liturgy. We don't greet each other as we walk in, although we often do. The passing of the peace is structured in order to have that tie to communion and the unity of the body and the avoiding conflict between one another, that this communal meal that we take is initiated first by a relational unity across the body.
Right. It is a signifier of our, like you said, is a signifier of our unity, is a signifier of our familial identity as much as our baptism is. Hmm. But it is physical. And, you know, Aaron last Sunday mentioned that sort of in his discussion about the passing of the peace, why it's important. That's an important part of the way we worship. And these are aspects of, these are parts of the liturgy that we include to encourage and help people, to remind people that the way we worship is not simply an internal thing. It is physical. And that's one aspect of it. It's physical in the sense that we greet each other, we touch each other, we, you know, give each other handshakes, we, you know, make eye contact. We recognize ourselves as a family. And then we come to the table. I like the, I want to read a quote from someone that kind of captures sort of the spiritual aspect of the passing of the peace and the physical aspect of it, and ties it together very beautifully. So I'm gonna do that. It's about a paragraph. It might help us to kind of talk about it. It's by one of my favorite authors. He's actually an Orthodox author. His name's Alexander Schmemann, and he talks about the Holy Case. And this is what he says. We forget that in the call to greet one another with a holy kiss, we are talking not of our personal natural human love, through which we cannot in fact love someone who is a stranger, who has not yet become something or somebody for us, but of the love of Christ, the eternal wonder of which consists precisely in the fact that it transforms the stranger and each stranger in his depths as an enemy into a brother, irrespective of whether he has or does now have relevance for me and for my life. That is the very purpose of the church, to overcome the horrible alienation that was introduced into the world by the devil and proved to be its undoing. And this is why in antiquity the assembly of the faithful was called not to a verbal answer, but precisely to an action. And that action is the holy kiss. So he seems to capture the fine line between understanding the passing of the peace as both a spiritual and physical act. He also seems to capture the essence of the conflict within the act itself. In no way, and this is what I want us to kind of wrestle with, in no way does a hug or a handshake or even a kiss begin to mend the inherent brokenness of human relationships with each other. Every holy kiss given on a Sunday is in essence a kiss of Judas. But the passing of the peace, by the work of the Spirit, becomes a pointer to Christ's work in and through his people. A people who are at peace with each other only by the grace of Christ. And the passing of the peace will mean different things to different people, but it should embody and enact the peace and shalom that Christ has given his people to pass to each other.
Yeah. So what he's getting at there, especially towards the end, is this presence of God peace that we've been talking about, that our liturgy is saturated with God's involvement in these things that can feel like our actions predominantly. And so let's talk a little about that, the way that the Spirit is moving in that act.
I think it's important to recognize then that as forgiven Christians called to unity, to mend our hostilities, that we can only do that in any real way, we can only do that because of Christ's presence among us. So Christ makes himself present because he has called us to unity. I guess what I'm trying to say, and we're always trying to push this when we're talking about the liturgy, that the act itself is symbolic in the sense that it is a sign of our unity, but is also a recognition of Christ's presence among us as we forgive each other. As we come in unity to the table.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, like Schmemann says, whether that's real or not, it most, you know, in a very real sense, we're constantly alienated from each other. Thus, we have to depend on Christ's grace and sacrifice to come to the table pure in heart.
Yeah, I'm struck by the language that we use on Sunday mornings. We use a fairly similar call and response most Sundays. I'm looking at page 10 of our order from last week, and you'll see it on most page 10s of our order of worship. But we repeat this, the peace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with you and also with you. And then it's lift up your hearts. We lift them up to the Lord. There's this, that little two-piece pattern is both the extension of Jesus is the one who is providing this peace. It is the one that is making it capable for us to do this. And then we respond in kind.
Right.
And then immediately after that, it tells us to greet each other in the name of Christ. This, the presence of God is, and the work of Christ is embedded within this peace that makes it not just a social hour or a greeting period, right? It's different than our cocktail hour at the wedding.
Right.
Because it is embedded first and foremost by this recognition of the work of Christ and the ongoing work of the Spirit within our within ourselves and within our community, our ability to reach out to one another.
Right.
I think my husband grew up Episcopalian, and when we worship with his family, it is much, the structure is very similar of the passing of the peace, but everyone says, the peace of Christ be with you and also with you. This is, you don't say hi. You have used some variation of offering peace to one another, in this grounding in the work of Christ. And that's, you'll hear some people do that on Sunday morning. I often do, in fact, and other people say hello, other people catch up, right? We use that space a little differently as individuals, but the, whether we are actively saying the peace of Christ be with you, or if we are greeting one another without that, that formal language, it still underrides our actions, that it is the Spirit within us that makes it possible for us to approach one another.
Exactly. And it is, yeah, it is always the reminder. The reminder is, again, that there is nothing inherently in and of ourselves. We cannot come to each other unified truly without the grace of Christ. And as a placement, I mean, right before the table, it's very poignant, of course, and a recognition, especially, again, these are all very physical acts that are taking place. We pass the peace, we give of our gifts, and then we go into the communion, you know, all these very physical aspects of our worship time, important physical aspects of our worship time.
Yeah, maybe we move in that direction to talk about how these acts form us. We do these things, and we do these things with purpose. So what are some of the ways that we see that shaping us? I think in the Shmaiman article, he talked about how in the passing of the peace, we approach each other as familiar, not as as enemies. He used that language in particular, in the separation of the alienation. And I think particularly about that choice of words, as the other as enemy, which is a very strong statement, and yet how we often engage in the world. It is the, I choose to go to a particular Jewish philosopher when I talk about these things, to Martin Buber, in the his work I Versus Thou, which has been helpful in my thought about community. And he talks about particularly, we can approach people, it's always the I-you relationship. There's me, and then there's you. And there's no sense of unity or intimacy, that we always approach people as the other. And that is a natural inclination for us. And so this act of greeting one another with intention, as one of our own, to use that early Christian familial piece, right?
Yeah.
Is a breaking down in some degree of this othering that we so naturally do with other people.
Sure. And it's formative in this sense, especially in this, for a couple things, right? For our culture, who is deeply, you know, kind of individualistic. Mm-hmm. The, you know, to use language we occasionally use, it's this part of the liturgy is a protest against that individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, honestly, that's why I think we prefer to kind of be in our own little bubbles when we come to worship. We want to confess, we want to bow our heads, we want to think about our own sin, we want this to be a, you know, kind of an internally focused time. We're kind of devoting ourselves internally to the, you know, God's presence, and we're singing, and we're closing our eyes. These are all, of course, good things, but I'm saying it's this sort of internalization of our worship experience is magnified because our culture, I think, values our individualism and values our sort of personal or you know, personal growth. And so the passing of the peace, in a way, is a way for us to recognize and protest against that particular, you know, thinking.
You know, it's the, there's this part of church that is about community as well as our individual relationship with God. And it's those two things that work together on Sunday morning. We don't worship together because that's practical to not each have our own personal preacher. We worship together because there's an active benefit to that. I think about, there was a phase in college where I was attending Covenant actually at the time, and maybe only made it to Covenant half the time. I would drive to Covenant and then end up at the Starbucks over, or not the Starbucks, Panera Bread across from the Target on Elston. That particular one, because I was so overwhelmed with the idea of having to be in the presence of other people. Part of it was about feeling unknown, right? I was at that point in time attending here, and my friends who had been coming had stopped coming with me. So I was just by myself. And some was the reality of being introverted and feeling exhausted by people in a college environment where you were constantly inundated with people. But some of it was bluntly about this battle of understanding the relational component of church. I wanted God all to myself. That was easier and safer than being a peer to people in all of these places and recognizing the broader community of faith. And so I think the passing of the peace is uncomfortable for people who are introverted or people who are newer to the faith, or for all kinds of reasons. There might be eras where people are uncomfortable with the passing. Yeah. And that uncomfortability serves a purpose to remind us of that while our faith is both our own, it is also shared, that we are not these people in silos worshiping God, that we do it as this, this grand chorus, both in our local communities and in our global community.
Sure. Yeah. And we'll, you know, when we come and we talk about, you know, the confession of sin, we'll dig into what it means to confess sin communally rather than just personally. And that'll highlight, I think, even more what we're talking about. But I think, you know, and I think this has been exacerbated even more during this pandemic, when people have grown used to the idea or gotten comfortable with the idea of this sort of a devotional, I can have church on my own terms mentality. You know, I can watch it when I, you know, when I'm comfortable doing it, and I can do it on, you know, I can listen to the music. I don't have to, you know, I have to interact with anybody. I can just kind of do it in the comfort of my home. And it was, of course, necessary for a while. But it was never the way the church was meant to be, right? And it's definitely highlighted, you know, as we've gotten past some, the shutdown. It's definitely highlighted that disparity. I think there are those still comfortable doing this away from the body of Christ. And we ought to be encouraged again to come together, as uncomfortable as it might be. But anyway.
I think about even this past Sunday is the first time we had a passing of the peace in 18 months.
Yeah, right.
Maybe actually longer than that. It would have been early March of 2020. And so even as we gathered again, right, there was, we chose to take a more cautious approach to the physical intimacy.
Yeah, sure.
And we've reached a point now where we said this, it's time for us to return to those things. And even as Pastor Aaron mentioned on Sunday, right, when he initiated this, there's options for how you participate. Yeah, for sure. You can shake hands. Yep. Plenty of people hugged. I don't know if I saw anybody kiss. but, you know, he gave the option, right? Like, you can wave. You can keep your physical distance as well. Like, we have to make space for people in different spots. But it doesn't negate the act. And there will be, over time, a movement, I think, to more intimacy. I have an immunocompromised stepdad, and so in some ways our COVID cautiousness about the passing of the peace is replicated every Sunday for him. A cold could be a hospitalization for him, and so when they go to church and they pass the peace, it's hand sanitizer before, during, and after. And it's this both recognition of the importance of like that physical act of intimacy with Christians, but also in their context, how do we do this in a way that feels safe? And so we've been in this exploratory phase in some ways, but coming back to it felt important, even if it may have felt uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I also thought, I think about the placing of the passing of the peace before, and I read this recently too, passing of the peace before the table. It serves to keep the Eucharist from becoming too individualized, and the action surrounding the table. So we, we purposefully come as a community greeting each other. And we'll talk now. I think we should probably transition into the giving time. We kind of use this as part of the service where we're giving of our gifts as a physical way and a communal way to help us come to the table, recognizing again, and we'll talk again, even when we talk about the table. Our tendency again, I think, is to kind of process the table sort of an internalized, sort of inward-looking experience. And I think having the peace before the table helps us to recognize the communal aspect of it.
Yeah, let's talk about giving and how that ties in here. So giving, like the passing of the peace, is something that, while not removed in a robust way from our liturgy, was not placed in its normal spot, right?
Like we've right.
traditionally had right. a very structured time of giving. It fell later in the service. It was in response to the table, right? Usually it was after
It was even after. Was it before? Yeah, I think it was before announcements and after the table, right?
Yeah, we would pass offering plates very, very traditionally. Right. And it was something that pre-COVID we were talking about. What does it look like to change this in a changing world where we give differently and we interact differently with our finances? And so now that we've brought it back in, it's yeah. in some ways, a much more subdued way. It's, you could miss it in our Sunday morning. In the liturgy, we now cluster it as passing the peace and preparing the gifts. And in there, in fine print, right, is a statement about giving.
You should read it.
Okay, I'm going to read that. Giving back to God a portion of what he's already given us is an important part of the Christian life. The bread and wine we use in communion are a picture of the gifts that God has given us, offered back to him as an act of worship. You can offer your resources back to God in support of the work of the church by placing your offering in the boxes on the way out, or you can give online or by texting a donation, right? So that latter half is pragmatic. But that first half is this: how do we orientate ourselves to giving, and why is that a part of Sunday morning? So maybe sure. we talk a bit about that piece first.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's good to remind ourselves again, and I think we always kind of start off with sort of early church practice, not because it's not a historization of the we're not kind of looking back simply and nostalgically saying we ought to do this because the early church did it because it, I don't know, it's more meaningful or something like that. It's not purely that we're trying to do that. We're trying to look at what the early church did in context because they are nearer to the time when Christ was there. We want to capture the for lack of a better word, the energy of what the early church was doing because we want to get a sense of what was important to them to help us elucidate how our practice is now. Okay, so all that to say, it's I think important to remember that the giving of the gifts was always an act of this thanksgiving before the table. It was people bringing bread and bringing wine and bringing gifts for the poor and bringing money. It was, it was a whole wealth of things that was being done. And then the pastor or the priest would take the bread and use the bread that was given and use the, wine that was given as the liturgical part of their service. They would break the bread there. So it's good to remember that we have sort of disconnected that part. We've kind of done the bread and the wine and the table by itself, and then we do the giving later. It's good to remember that the giving of the gifts has always been integral to the table. It's always been a part of the movement of the Eucharist,
and that has some orientation even further back in early Judaism in the Old Testament, right? With the tithing system and the offerings, that tithes were functional. They both fed your priest, and they were acts of worship. This relationality of of our gifts or the things that we bring to God as a functional component. I think that can be missed at times.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you get the sense from some of the source material from that time. There's a physicality to it. It reminds me, you know, I'm a missionary kid. I grew up in West New Guinea, and there were portions of our service. You know, they didn't have like a formal structured money system. You know, they didn't. And so when the church gave its offerings during their services, it would be this, you know, kind of movement of people getting up and bringing a portion of their sweet potatoes or a portion of their gardens. And there would be a big pile of food and goods at the front of the church. Then that would be passed out, you know, to those who needed it, or those who didn't have a good crop, or those who were suffering, or those, you know, or for the pastor. So it had this very there was a physicality to it it was compelling and it was beautiful.
My cultural upbringing was quite a bit different growing up in a small town in Indiana, but there was a piece of that we did every year as well. In the church where I grew up, we rarely celebrated Halloween, but we did celebrate harvest season. And growing up in a farm town, it meant people literally brought the first fruits of their crop to the church, and it would sit on the altar and then be generally redistributed to the congregation. And so most of our congregants at least had like a small family farm, if not a robust business farm. And the same, like, fresh milk would be a part of that, right? Like, that would then be used during our coffee hour or our potluck brunches. But this idea of bringing of your handiwork for the good of the community. Yeah, it's interesting to see those two very different cultures and different ways of doing that, but seeing that embedded in both.
Exactly.
And it can feel like a bigger jump to the way that we do it in most churches. And even in my childhood church, right, like, that was not our predominant giving. That was kind of a harvest season ritual of thanks. But it can feel more removed in a cash-oriented society to think about the giving of our gifts in this sharing of our handiwork element.
Yeah. I have some ideas on how we're, as a church, going to make this more physical. And part of it is placing this time of giving right there during the greeting and recognizing attaching it to sort of the physicality of the time of greeting and to the table. But I think there are ways that we as a church can do things that are more physical in nature. So, you know, for example, there are times we've given, you know, we have these drives to give
to our mercy bin.
And I think what I would like to do is open up this time during the greeting where we actually, instead of like stuffing the stuff in the mercy bin, we can actually bring those things up to the altar, or at least to the stage, as, again, for us to help us to see the physicality of it, to help us to give during those times, to help us recognize as a community what we're doing.
Let's talk a little. So we used to have a very physical act of giving component, right? We passed offering plates, and you had to touch that plate, regardless if you gave online or if you weren't giving, or whatever your relationship was to it. You had to deal with the presence of this plate being passed in front of you. And for many years, right, especially if you sat in the front half of the church, you were passing an empty plate.
Yeah, right.
So let's talk about why we moved away from that particular physical act and how else we can think about that physical act.
Right. So, I mean, that's why I talked about being more creative on the ways that we can give. I mean, I think passing around an empty plate, although it seems like a good way to signify the physicality of it, I think there are better ways that we can do it, and I think that's why we were moving towards doing something a little different during that time, just because people give online, and you know, we also, if you remember again, we also sent out a survey about the time of giving, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, to a portion of the congregation. Well, partly because we wanted to ask, is this making sense? You know, what one of the questions we asked was, you know, as you see the plate passing around, what do you think, what does that say how Covenant thinks about money? Mm-hmm. And we asked that. We asked how, you know, how does it make people feel to pass around an empty plate? With the idea, hoping that maybe people would get, you know, feel like, yes, we're passing around an empty plate, but we recognize its, you know, significance of physicality. But we didn't get that response. Right. We got mostly a, doesn't make much sense. We don't know what the Covenant thinks about money. So that's why we kind of,
it almost, right, it can feel like an NPR giving drive, which is nonstop, right? This like, oh, are you telling me that I'm not giving enough? Right? Like this, it can connotate something very different than the intention. And so moving away from that, certainly COVID helped that, right? We're like, do we pass shared objects at the moment? But also this recognition that doing things the same way, just because we've always done them that way, even if they have good intention, if it's not communicating that intention, isn't the right way of doing it anymore. And so, you know, I think it's safe to say this, you can tell me if I'm wrong, we're kind of in a period of rediscovery of what this looks like. We want giving to be a significant part of our service.
Right.
Because it is a particularly important part of our liturgical orientation.
Yeah.
And that it does have an important place in this spot in the liturgy. But figuring out what it looks like to recognize that in a world where most of us that give regularly do it through auto donations.
Yeah.
Or at least online in some digital capacity, even if not an auto give setup. There is a separation of Sunday morning from giving, even if it's not a separation in our orientation to giving.
And it is also, again, a good reminder that one of the marks of the church in Acts was this sort of, I read recently. In fact, there's another book that I just want to tell you about by Craig Blomberg. It's called Neither Poverty Nor Riches. It's a biblical theology of possessions. It's really a great book, but he again references source material as well, but you get the sense from the church in Acts that there's this sort of like reckless generosity, like almost, you know, almost like from our perspective, you know, not wise in the way they gave money or the way they, you know, gave of themselves or their possessions. It's a reminder again to us that one of the responses of our recognition of Christ's mercy or God's grace to us is this inherent sense of thankfulness that is our giving is a physical representation of our thankfulness. It is a natural outflow of what God has given us.
That it's a recognition of the two ways of giving, that we both, we have received boldly from the grace of God.
Right.
And so we too are called to give boldly, that this is a, that giving isn't a thing that we do in order to like make sure that we can do tuck pointing every year in the church. Funds are used that way. But it's about something bigger than that. It's about a recognition of what we have received and a sense of gratitude in that.
Yeah.
And that can be, I think, again, right? I think about these, where do we give culturally? Most of us are inundated, especially this time of year, with year-end giving drives, right? Like, I think I got 6 different letters in the mail yesterday asking me to give to various nonprofits and cultural institutions that I've supported over the years. And I think it can be easy for us to put Christian giving in that same category. This is how we make year-end goals. It's a tax deduction, right? And those things are true, right? There's pragmatic components to giving. But it isn't our first orientation to it. We don't give first and foremost to make sure like we can keep our building in good repair and all the staff are still employed.
Yeah.
But we give first about our relationality to God in a response of gratitude, and that is the orientation in which we come to giving.
Yeah, right. Right. Yes. And part of the reason why we put the giving, like I've already explained a little bit, why we put the giving next to the table, as well as the peace, is we are, you know, we're adding liturgical weight to that practice. We're suggesting that this isn't just sort of at the end of the service, you know, let's give. It's more of a recognition that it is a response to God's grace. And it is an act of thankfulness. With the idea, again, in the practice of the liturgy, that this forms us in a particular way. It helps us think about money in a particular way. It helps us think about our possessions in a particular way.
Yeah.
And to think about it tangibly, our possessions meaning not just sort of our bank money, but our possessions as it is, you know, our bread and our wine. You know, these are our, you know, ourselves. This is much, the giving is something that is whole-bodied. I'm going to take a moment to read another Schmemann quote. He talks about giving, which I thought was, again, beautiful. And maybe that'll help us, again, to kind of to capture the spiritual element of it and the physical element of it. He does, I think, a good job of kind of capturing both of those things. So this is what he says. In the consciousness, in the experience, and in the practice of the early church, the Eucharistic sacrifice was offered not only on behalf of all and for all, but by all. And therefore, the real offering by each of his own gift, his own sacrifice, was a basic condition of it. Each person who came into the gathering of the church brought with him everything that, as he had made up his mind from 2 Corinthians, he could spare for the needs of the church. And this meant for the sustenance of the clergy, for the widows, the orphans, for helping the poor, for all the good works in which the church realizes herself as the love of Christ, as concern of all, for all, and service of all, to all. Again, he captures very, I think, poignantly the role of our giving as realizing our being the face or the hands and the feet of Christ himself.
So we talked about, right, we've been moving through this this movement of the liturgy in the center of our order. We come to this part of our liturgy with responses to what we have received already. And we'll work backwards in other weeks and cover some of those things that preceded this within the structure of our liturgy. This sharing and this communal passing of the peace, this giving in a state of gratitude in response to what God has given us, and in preparation then for the table, for communion, which we do weekly now. We'll talk about communion later, but we have something called the Great Thanksgiving that we do every Sunday before we partake of this family meal together. And so we want to talk a little about the structure of that. What are we saying and why are we saying that? So first, what is the Great Thanksgiving? Why do we call it that?
It is the practice of the church before the table over the centuries, starting actually with, again, with the early church. It was a way to verbalize in kind of a liturgical format the response to God's mercy and God's grace in Thanksgiving. There are the core of the Great Thanksgiving that we start off pretty much every week with. Can you read that, just the beginning part of it?
Yeah. So with clear hearts and minds, let us give thanks to the Lord our God. It is right to give him thanks and praise.
Right. So that beginning, that it is right to give him thanks and praise, has been part of the church's liturgy almost right from the start. It is part of part of the Jewish prayer, prayers that the synagogue was using, was co-opted by the Christian church and used as their liturgy before the table. And it, you know, it has grown into what we, you know, we, the way we use it on a weekly basis, a much smaller version than what the entire Great Thanksgiving is. And we've also done it differently as well. We do it very differently in the sense that we make it a call and response. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Roman Catholic Church in other traditions, it is just done by the priest. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you've been at Covenant for a while, right, this has taken different shapes over the years. Our current format is actually an abbreviation of what we've done in the past.
Right.
In part so that we could start bringing back some of those other orders of service back. But even as we've shaped it differently, the main ideas have remained the same. This pattern of praise and recognition of who God is.
Right. And, you know, the structure of the Great Thanksgiving has always been, as someone once told me, it's sort of like the greatest hits of God's works. it walks through the Old Testament. It sometimes, you know, gives these stories of how God has interacted covenantally with the people of God. And it, you know, in the full form, the Great Thanksgiving does this like long, you know, scripted description. It almost has sort of a psalmic sort of feel to it, where it talks about how God, you know, saved the people of Israel, and it kind of walks through all, like I said, the greatest hits of God's salvation, redemptive work, then ending, of course, with Christ.
I think. Particularly one that's poignant for me is the one that we used during Lent often, where we talk about this pattern of 40 days.
Right.
And so we run, the spectrum of scripture and talking about where God has worked in his people. Reminder and the retelling of one another of these Bible stories and this shorthand to say, do you see what God has done in the marvelous way that he's worked in our world?
Yeah. And so the 40-day one is unique to our experience, our church, because I added a lot of text to that and I made it more, there are aspects of that you can find in other Great Thanksgivings. But again, the Great Thanksgiving has become, much more used in the church, over the last, 30, 40 years. And there's a lot of debate, as I understand, with the Roman Catholic Church as to, you know, what's the appropriate way to use the Great Thanksgiving. And of course, you know, there's, you know, people who think that you should only use the traditional Great Thanksgiving.
It feels in some ways like a question about creeds, right? So our religious tradition recognizes the Westminster Confession of Faith as one of our guiding documents. But we use different confessions and different creeds in our service. And there's intra-denomination disagreement, right?
Right.
About like, how broad do you get to go? Whose creeds do you, or whose confessions do you use?
Right.
And some of that has been reflected back in these other structural pieces.
Yeah.
Who gets to play with these things and what version is right or proper.
Right.
And so certainly different churches and different denominations end up in different places, and we've had this looser relationship to it. We recognize it's important, and yet have also said we can take the form and basic ideas and make it uniquely our own or touch on it in different ways. And I think that's a beautiful way of engaging with literature.
Yeah, I think so too. And I felt it important, you know, to put the words of the Great Thanksgiving into the mouths of the congregation. So that's why we do it in this sort of call and response style. So it becomes almost creedal in nature. It has similar appeal to a creed, because we're kind of going through the work of Christ. To state the obvious, it is a prayer of thanksgiving. It is putting ourselves in a posture of gratitude before we come to the table. It is a way, and it's supposed to be celebratory.
Yeah.
It should have a feel of celebration. But I want us as a congregation to come to the table in celebration again, because I feel like for our tradition in the Protestant church, we tend to kind of look inwardly when we come to the table, and we want to we want to experience this sort of somberly.
There's an Eeyore-ness.
Yeah. Right. And I feel like the Great Thanksgiving before the table, ending with the Sanctus Benedictus, when we go, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. I feel like that this is a shout of praise.
It's, I think, important, right, to give context, particularly those for people like me, right, who maybe grew up with an understanding of communion that was largely about gravity. The way at least it was communicated to me in my early upbringing was that communion was this very serious act. It was the body and blood of Christ. And maybe it wasn't taught to me this way. This is just how I internalized it. I'll give some credence there. But the idea was I was so bad, that Jesus's life needed to be taken for me. And so I received this in seriousness of the cost of my actions, right? This is the legalism that I internalized in my youth. And so to re-script that in some ways, to not downplaying the gravity of sin or the substantial gift that Christ has given, but instead that we celebrate it.
Right.
And that we take communion each week in the celebration of this gift and with recognition of who God is, the robustness of his status and his generosity towards us. Recasting that same act in that tone, I think, is, certainly important.
Sure. So we're using a shortened version of the Great Thanksgiving right now. And you'll experience it differently during different parts of the season. So for Advent, it'll change a little. And for the season of Epiphany, it'll change a little. And for Lent, again, though, we'll probably go back to that, the 40 days Great Thanksgiving.
Maybe a shortened 40 days.
Maybe a shortened one, 20 days. No. I don't know. So we have to, you'll see this form differently through the seasons of the church as a way to recognize our movement through salvation history, as it were.
Yeah. And some, too, our continued shaping of what does it look like for us to do this liturgy together and thinking through those things, right?
Yeah.
The Great Thanksgiving has shaped it over the years as we think through what does this look like to do this robustly and well in a way that is formative for our congregation. I think that's one of the gifts of our liturgy, is both to have this structure and to have that freedom of movement, both in your role structuring it, but then for us as a congregation to put new words on that and to see it in a slightly different light at different times.
Yeah, I mean, I've always, of course, made it an important part of the way when I think about the liturgy, is I want this to be meaningful to you all who are taking part in it. It has to be culturally, it has to make sense culturally to us where we are. So if I have to, reword, the Great Thanksgiving in a way that makes it more sensible for us, then I have the freedom to do that, and I think other traditions might not. So that's why I feel like it. We have the privilege, I guess, of experiencing the liturgy in different forms as we go through it. That maybe other churches don't. But at the same time, I don't want to make it so chaotic all the time. And it's always changing. And I feel like I'm moving in a direction where I want to give a little more stability to the way we perform the liturgy so that it makes sense for us.
I think in some ways that might be a good nod to what we're covering next week. So next week, one of the components that we're talking about is the creeds. And similar, right, there's this structure in which we say them often. But we sometimes use different creeds, and there's intentionality in that act. We'll talk a bit about creeds next week, and then also the call to worship and invocation. So we're kind of capstoning our service. We often end on a creed on the weeks right. that we have them, but we open our service with the call to worship and invocation. So next week, we'll talk about those three elements together and think through both that that structure, that stability of our worship, and that dynamic of change, how we vary it to make it sensible and to make it heard to us in new ways.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that next week on our class that will be released on Thursday. And I hope that you join us on Sunday at 10:15 as we discuss what we talked about this week in a group discussion in the All Saints room. So I hope you'll join us. Thanks.